In our scripture text this morning, we will be primarily in John chapter 4. Of course, we'll look at a lot of other texts, but we'll be in John chapter 4 for the most part this morning. When I was still in college, I went out to McDonald's with one of my school college buddies who was kind of a prankster, if you can imagine that. You never knew what to expect when you were with him, and I'm sure he thought the same about me. But as we were in line getting ready to order, Glenn reached around me. He was standing behind me. He reached around and pinches this 80-year-old lady who was standing right in front of me, right in her side. I remember this like it was yesterday. She was ordering, I'll take a cheeseburger, Coke, and some, ooh. And I looked around to see where Glenn was, and he was already gone. She spins around and she makes eye contact with me, and she didn't have this I'm like angry look or disgusted look. It was more of a like thank you look. Can I have your number? And I'm just not good at moments like that. You know, the first thing that came to mind was to apologize, which only made me look more guilty than I already wasn't. No doubt you have probably been in situations like that where. You said the wrong thing at the wrong time. It's kind of like these people that I'm going to show you in a second who are coming out of the fog of anesthesia. God bless them. They have people who love them, but take videos of these moments for the world to see. Watch.
I got no pair. I have no feeling. I can't feel my toes. Look at
that. Oh. How do I wake up? How do I wake up?
You're waking
up.
You're waking up.
Where? Where am I?
She'll get upset if she sees you touching me like that on my chest.
I don't know.
Sup.
I don't know if you can hear her, but the wife says, I am your wife. Well, today we're going to look at a story where there's a woman who says exactly the right thing at exactly the right time. But in order to fully appreciate her statement, you need to have a little bit of context. I'll just try and set up for you this way. The world that Jesus was born into was a very divided world. That might be an understatement, actually, by a lot. Men and women were divided. The religious and the irreligious lived on different sides of the street. Ethnic people were separated out from one another. And so in antiquity, what brought people together was very often a meal. Interestingly enough, food is what would bring people together. So if you were someone's friend, you would be invited to sit at their table. But if you were their enemy, you would not be invited to sit at their table. And one of the most commonly words used in ancient literature to describe an enemy is the word dog. Dog just was translated for those folks as enemy. Dogs were not pets in the days of Jesus. As a matter of fact, for the most part, dogs were scavenger animals that rummaged through trash and fought over the scraps. They didn't have dog food and live in people's homes. They roamed the street and found food wherever they could find it. So I think the folks in Jesus' day would have had a hard time trying to categorize Doug the pug. This Instagram star, who's famous for living in a $10,000 doghouse, Doug the pug has designer clothes sent to him. He only drinks purified water, and he has an acupuncturist that helps him deal with stress. And I wish I was exaggerating this or making it up, but I'm not. I don't think the folks in Jesus' day would have understood our infatuation with dogs. It just would have been a foreign concept to them. So what's interesting in the story is what Jesus will do in this conversation, what other religious leaders would not do. We're going to see him engage in a way that other religious leaders would not do. The first step that we see him do is that he leaves this country, he leaves his home, to go to a foreign territory. He leaves Israel and heads right into the heart of a pagan territory, an area known as Tyre, T-Y-R-E, a little coastal city that sits along the Mediterranean Sea. It's up near the top of your screen. Roman ships would deliver goods to various ports along the seaside there. And then after they had all their deliveries made, the destination for the sailors would be Tyre. This is where sailors would let their hair down, and they would indulge in all things sinful. Probably the way to describe it best in that day is what happened in Tyre stayed in Tyre, which means no Jewish person of any good reputation would get within eyesight of this city, let alone step foot into it. But Jesus goes, and not only does he go to Tyre, once he's there, he engages in a conversation with a woman, which religious men didn't do either, and not just any woman, but a woman whose daughter was living with an evil spirit inside of her. So here's what you have to remember. Jesus is now in an unclean city, having a conversation with an unclean woman whose daughter had an unclean spirit inside of her. Scandalous on every level. That's why Mark tells the story this way. Then Jesus left Galilee and went north to the region of Tyre. He tried to keep it secret that he was there, but he couldn't. As usual, the news of his arrival spread fast. Right away, a woman came to him whose little girl was possessed by an evil spirit. She had heard about Jesus, and now she had come and fell at his feet. She begged him to release her child from the demon's control. Since she was born a Gentile, born in Syrian Phoenician, Jesus told her, "First, I should help my own family, the Jews. It isn't right to take food from the children and throw it to the dogs." If you know anything about Jesus, this is not what you would expect him to say. It's an interesting story. It's not one we study. It's another one of these stories that we don't study often, but here it is for us today. Right here in this conversation, we have Jesus acknowledging a real racial tension that exists between the Jews and this group, another group of people. I don't think in this moment that Jesus is trying to expand the difference or this canyon between the Jews and the Gentiles by calling this woman a dog. I don't think that's what's happening, although that's what it looks like on the surface. I think he's doing just the opposite. He's testing her. He's seeing if she will help bridge the gap, this distance between these two people groups. I mean, he's gone out of his way to go to this city. He's there for a reason. He's trying to make a positive difference. I really think he's testing her. Now, as you read this story, though, and other stories like it in the New Testament, there's this phrase that you're going to see come up from time to time, and it's this little phrase: first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. You'll see that several times in the New Testament. And what I want you to do is remember that Jesus is delivering God's plan of salvation to the world. I mean, that's what he's doing here. He has to start with someone. So he starts with his own people first. As students of the Bible, I want you to understand this concept. Sequence does not indicate favoritism, but function. Jesus is delivering this incredible gift of salvation to all of humanity, but he's going to start with the Jewish people. That makes sense. He was a Jew himself. The Jews have been God's people all throughout the Old Testament. And from there, it's going to extrapolate to all of the other nations and countries. The woman Jesus is talking to seems to understand that. She seems to be okay with that. So let me take it a step further. First for the Jew, and then for the Gentile. This would be like you're going to throw a pool party or a barbecue at your house. So you invite your family, your friends. You send a text message out to everyone. "Hey, party at my house, 6 o'clock. Hope you can make it." Saturday rolls around, and about 5 o'clock, your doorbell rings. You open the door, and there's one of your relatives standing there on the front porch with a watermelon in her hands. And you have two choices now, right? You can say, "Well, hey, listen, glad you can make it. The party doesn't start until 6, though. Why don't you wait here on the porch, and I will come get you when we're ready to start." Or you can say, "Hey, come on in. Make yourself at home. We'll be ready in about an hour." Well, what are you going to do? Of course, you're going to do the latter, right? This is your family member. It's someone you care about. It's someone you want there. She's just early. That woman that Jesus is talking to is early for the party that God is throwing for humanity. And again, she seems to know this. She seems to understand it and be okay with it. So, and so does Jesus. Listen to what she says. "That's true, Lord. But even the dogs under the table are given some crumbs from the children's plates." Translation, she's saying, "Jesus, a family's meal doesn't have to be interrupted, and a child's nourishment doesn't have to be neglected for the dog under the table to get a few crumbs." I'll translate that now too. "Jesus, you can help the Gentiles without hurting the Jews." Brilliant on her part, actually unbelievable. Couldn't have said it better myself. And Jesus acknowledges that. He says, "Good answer. And because you've answered so well, I have healed your daughter." That alone would make a great sermon, just talking about the healing, but we're not going to go there this morning. The scandal in this interaction, I think, is lost on us because we're not living with the ethnic tension that was really existing between the Jews and the Samaritans of that day, or the Jews and the Gentiles. So I'm going to try and put this on a shelf where you can understand it, really kind of relate to what's going on in this story. Because what I want you to do is I want you to see that Jesus is inviting people under the table to sit at the table. That's what's going on here. If you're willing to eat with Jesus, he's willing to eat with you. Which means today after church, if Jesus were here, right here with us, and he came up to you after church and says, "Hey, can I use your house today?" You'd be like, "Yeah, Jesus, you're Jesus. You can use my house anytime you want." So he goes home with you, and he says, "Hey, I'm just going to need your dining room table. Can you prepare a little snack?" And in your mind, you're starting thinking, I don't have anything for a party. But he knows what you're thinking. So he says, "Hey, how about just some chips and salsa? Just put some chips and salsa on the table, it'll be fine." So you put out the chips and salsa, and as soon as you have that on the table, the doorbell rings. You go to answer it, and you're just shocked at who's there. You weren't expecting anyone else to begin with, just Jesus. But you go to the door, and there is Albert Einstein. Standing right next to him is Adolf Hitler. And Jesus is like, "Come on in." And he brings them into your home and sits them at your dining room table right across from each other. And he starts with a joke to kind of lighten the mood. And then by the end of the conversation, they're all talking. A Jewish scientist and a man who lived to kill all Jews. And then Jesus says, "Hey, before you guys leave, exchange contact information." He escorts them to the back door. He says, turns to you now and says, "Oh, we're just getting started. Not done. Do you have any more food?" "Well, can make some brownies." So you make some brownies, you put them on the dining room table. As soon as you get them on the dining room table, the doorbell rings. You're not surprised by the doorbell this time, but you are surprised by who's at the door when you open the door. You're shocked because they're standing at the door is Dr. Martin Luther King and Governor George Wallace. And in your mind thinking, this isn't going to go good. Here's the African-American civil rights movement leader of our day and the Southern prejudiced governor. Not going to go well. Jesus brings them in, sets them at the table, sets them across from each other, tells them our little joke. There's a little bit of tension in the room right now, but he gets them talking. And they have this conversation. And before they leave, he says, "Hey, exchange contact information, keep this going." And he escorts them out the back door. He's like, "All right, one more group. And you're like, "I'm out of food. There are no more chips and salsa, no more brownies." He says, "I'm just out." Jesus is like, "Ever hear of DoorDash?" So you order some wings, and you get the wings on the table, the doorbell rings, and when you open the door, there is Mr. Zelensky and Putin. And literally, I could go on and on and on and pick these most unrelationable type of people that now have to sit across the table from each other, and I think you're starting to get the point of what's happening with Jesus and this woman. And Jesus is breaking bread, eating from the same loaf now as this Canaanite woman. And that's why Jesus had the credibility to say things like, "Treat other people exactly the way you would like to be treated." That's not easy for me. I mean, I'll just be totally candid with you. I'm not a fan of terrorists. There's something in me that instinctively says, I'm not a fan of people who hurt women and children. I don't like people who leverage religion for selfish purposes to help or to hurt other people instead of helping other people. That bothers me a lot. Treat other people exactly the way as you want to be treated? It sounds great, but we all know we've got some people that would be hard for us to do, right? It'd be hard for me to do that for a terrorist or someone abusing religion. But it was easy for Jesus. That's why he said in Matthew 5, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. See, he understood if we could pray to the Father in heaven about our enemies, the God who is in heaven would help us love our enemies. Here's the challenge that goes on inside of me, and you can see if you can relate to this. When I'm dealing with someone who's difficult to love, I have one of two responses. I have an instinctive response, and I have a reflective response. Example, so if someone cuts me off in traffic, my instinctive response is to honk the horn many times, to put my hands up in the air and make a big motion so they know that I'm irritated with them, right? Other people have a little worse responses. But the reflective response in me is to stop and think, man, I wonder if they're having a bad day. I wonder if they got a screaming kid in the back seat who's just being a real distraction right now. Like, all of us have needed moments of grace when we're driving, right? We just needed someone to maybe be kind to us. Jesus is just constantly commanding us to crucify that instinctive response and to resurrect the reflective response. I was reading this study from a university in Canada. They were studying things that change a person's mood for the better. And one of the interesting lessons that emerged from this study was they determined that people speaking to strangers made people happy. That seemed counterintuitive to me, probably to most people, I think. We dart into coffee shops and gas stations and grocery stores and hope we don't see anyone because we're just in a hurry and we don't want to stop and talk, let alone talking to strangers. But the study showed that people who have sustained levels of happiness over a long period of time are people who talk to everyone. People they know, people they don't know. So what does that mean for us? That means I'm giving you permission today to become your parents, right? My parents talked to everybody. Drove me nuts. I would get embarrassed. I'm like, don't talk to them. What are we going to do now, right? So I'm giving you permission to just do this, maybe not to this degree.
There's a reason they don't call them clean bikes, am I right?
Yeah.
Because it's dirt bike.
Gas stations. Whew.
You got to start at the top and work your way down. You want me to do yours next?
Oh, you're from Oklahoma.
They have to fill the silence.
The bathroom code's 9914.
Progressive can't protect you from becoming your parents, but we can protect your home and auto when you bundle with us.
Look at this hot rodder! A lot of people sleep on Oklahoma. Florida gets all the praise for having a panhandle, but you guys got a panhandle too. Not everybody knows that.
If you think the gas pump is the place to spark up conversation with strangers, please watch some more of my videos right here.
Progressive did not pay us to put that up there. Here's the truth. In the field of psychology, there is this concept known as transference. Multiple layers of understanding. One of the layers, as an example, is this. Let's say you had a bad relationship with your mother growing up, right? Your two personalities just conflicted. It was like oil and water. Her behavior, your behavior, just was not going to work out very well. And so there's tension there. And then later in life, you meet a woman or work with a woman who reminds you somehow of your mother. And before you even know this person, you are transferring how you feel about your mom onto this person. Right? And this is what Jesus is talking about here. It can happen. We can do it in a positive way. We can do it in a negative way. Now, Jesus didn't say it. He showed us how to do it. So when I visualize Jesus living in our modern society today, if I try to imagine like he's right here physically with us, I can say with a pretty high level of confidence that I think Jesus would be very at ease in a prison or a rehab facility. I think he'd be comfortable sitting next to someone at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I think he'd be okay sitting in the front row of a divorce court. Maybe even comfortable sitting on the curb outside of a strip club. I think Jesus would be comfortable walking through the high school hallways, despite everything that's talked about and the way it's talked about. So what I struggle with sometimes is seeing how Jesus would sit in a church building. And for some reason, I just have a hard time contextualizing that. I'm not saying he wouldn't be comfortable here. I mean, he's here with us right now. I just don't know that he would spend the majority of his time here. I think he would spend the majority of his time in all those other places I just was talking about. I was trying to witness to a guy one time who wanted nothing to do with going to church. He didn't even want to hardly listen to me. And finally, to try and get me to stop, I'll never forget what he said. It caught me off guard. He said, "Randy, it's easier for me to get sex on the street than to get a hug in the church." I hope his experience here would be a whole lot different than that. We've experienced the grace of God in this place. And because we've experienced that grace, we recognize that we were under the table once ourselves. And Jesus pulled us out. He pulled out our guilt and our shame, and he sat us at a table where we don't deserve to sit. Aren't you grateful to be there? That's why the writer of Hebrews says, "See to it that no one misses out on the grace of God." Again, just another moment of transparency here. I am better at receiving grace than extending grace. I mean, somewhere in my heart, I want to treat everyone the way that I want to be treated. I want to see that no one misses the grace of God. But my intentions and my actions don't always line up with what I just said. That's even more why I need more of Jesus in my life. Because our leader, Jesus Christ, practiced what he preached in every circumstance, at every occasion, even from the cross. I mean, they stripped him naked, they beat him brutally, they accused him of all these sorts of things that he didn't do, and all the while this is going on, the biblical text says the crowds were heaping insults on him, and what did he do? "Father in heaven, forgive them." Look past it. They don't know what they're doing. In other words, Jesus loved people who hated him, and he asked us to do the same. The heart of this story with this Canaanite Phoenician woman is this important truth. No matter who you are, you matter to Jesus. You matter to Jesus and you matter to this church. I think we're going to get to heaven someday and we'll be shocked at some of the people who are actually there because we didn't get along with them so well down here. But because Jesus is at the table, we'll get along just fine. All of the disagreements, all of the petty disparities will disappear. Anne Klein is a Nazi prison camp survivor. She had been brutally mistreated by Nazi guards at Auschwitz. She was in the concentration camp as a teenager. And when the war ended, miraculously, she was still alive and set free. She didn't have anything at all to her name other than the ratty clothes on her back. She barely had shoes, no money, and she had to walk 400 miles from that camp back to Hungary. She was interviewed and she says that there were times, many times along that journey, when she thought she would freeze to death or starve to death, but somehow she made it home. When she got to her hometown, she walked into the neighborhood where she had been raised. And it hit her hard when she got there. It was totally silent. It was like a ghost town. She said, "Everyone I knew, everyone I loved, including my own family, had all been murdered. Every last one of them." She was relocated to the United States. She took up residence in Kentucky. She met a wonderful man, became her husband. She raised a beautiful family. But she said, "Every day I dealt with nightmares. Every day I seethed with anger." She said, "I would roll up my sleeve, and every time I look at my daughter, I'd see the number tattooed on my skin that would be there forever." Because that's all she was to the Germans, a number, not a person. And she became to understand that if she wasn't careful, that anger was going to consume her. And she started to pray and ask God over and over to help her forgive the people who robbed her of her dignity and who treated her worse than a dog. This lady was less than 5 feet tall, less than 100 pounds, but she proved to be a spiritual giant. God took the hatred out of her heart and replaced it with love. And if he can do it for her and everything she had been through, he can do it for you, no matter what you've been through. Just see to it that no one misses out on the grace of God. In our college chapel services, I heard a guy speak. His name is Steve Saint. His parents were a young missionary couple that got with four other couples and moved to the jungles of Ecuador to share the gospel with cannibalistic headhunting tribal people known as the Wadani people. When they got there, Steve was just a little boy. His dad and the other four missionary men made contact with the tribal leaders, and the tribal leaders felt threatened by these American missionaries. They brutally, savagely murdered all four of them. They discarded their lifeless bodies in a nearby river. It garnered national attention, even made the cover of Life magazine, because these women who had just had their husbands killed decided to stay in the jungle and complete the work that their husbands had started. They raised their children, their little children, in this terrible place. They decided they wanted to go and share the love of Jesus with these men who had murdered their husbands. And Steve said, "I remember my mom sitting down at the table and cooking, sharing food with these men who had thrown her husband's body like it was trash into the river." Steve said, "When I became a teenager, these men had all come to Christ. Churches had been planted throughout the jungle. Thousands of people had come to know Jesus Christ as Savior because of these men who were once murderers." He said, "And then I surrendered my life to Jesus as a teen. I needed to be baptized, and I wanted the men who murdered my dad to be the ones who baptized me in the same river where they had thrown his body." I'll never forget his testimony. Have you ever considered how petty we can get with this incredible gift of grace that we've gotten from God? See to it that nobody, that includes our worst enemies, misses the grace of God. Now I understand. I mean, I get it today. I don't deserve to be at the table, but I'm there. And he feeds us more than just crumbs. And I want to make sure you hear this. He loves you. I don't know what your experience with God has been. I don't know what your experience with the church has been. God loves you. And he can do something for you that I am not capable of doing, that your family is not capable of doing, that no other human is capable of doing. I want you to imagine our church is a boat, and our boat's aimed in one in the direction of one island, and that island is called freedom. Freedom from your past, freedom from your guilt, freedom from your shame, freedom from regret. Maybe you were baptized as a kid. For a lot of people, this is true. Mom and dad had good intentions. They pushed you toward it, but never really accepted Jesus on your own. You just kind of did what they wanted you to do. Maybe you didn't have parents like that at all. You don't know who Jesus Christ even is. You need to know this. He loves you. No matter what your motivation was or wasn't as a child, what is your motivation today? What is your plan for tomorrow? What is your hope for eternity? Don't put off accepting Christ as your Savior. Don't miss the grace that's being extended to you by our Lord Jesus Christ. Don't miss his words of love and comfort and acceptance. Don't put off his forgiveness. It doesn't matter if it's a concentration camp in Europe, a river in Ecuador, or a little pool somewhere else. I just want to make sure that none of you misses out on the greatest gift this world has ever received, which is God's grace.